And that was God's gift to me, because then I became multifunctional. And sometimes when you don't look so hard, but you just do a good job at what you're doing, it happens. You know, every discipline that you're responsible for, it should apply to, it's your mindset when you go to work. How can I make it better? You know, I mean, it's so easy to say no, and it's much harder to say yes, but you got to get to yes, and you got to be results oriented, and you got to take on these challenges, and you got to take on these risks, and you can't be afraid.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard, your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sign-In Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Well, Tricia, thank you for coming. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, John.
It's a blast to have you here. I mean, how long have we known each other now?
I was thinking it's got to be 20 years.
Close to 20, which is wild.
It's frightening.
And of course, I mean, for everybody's benefit, I know you from the work that we did together when you were director of security for the Army.
Right.
But, you know, and I think what most people might not know who have met you through me or, you know, who just haven't had a chance to read the full bio. I was reading through your bio again. It's like a greatest hits album of security jobs. I mean, there's director of security of the Army. Of course, the vetting work at Defense Counterintelligence Security Agency. But you were at SOCOM for a while. You did work at Navy. There's Missile Defense Agency. There isn't much that you haven't managed to get fingers into, which is amazing.
Yeah, it wasn't planned. It just kind of happened. And I think there's something to be said for that, you know, other than my father telling me a long time ago, don't stay in one place too long.
Well, that's probably good advice. I don't know if he meant for you to stay, you know, trapped in security for your whole life. You've done a lot of good. So I think everybody's better off because you did it. I mean, forgive me for dating you a little bit more. It's a little bit more than 40 years of doing this stuff.
41 years and 3 months.
There you go. I don't want to overdate it. That leaves aside, by the way, the work you've been doing lately for tech companies and startups. I mean, there's all kinds of cool stuff.
Another thing that wasn't planned.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, I would love to know. And it's often the first question I ask folks on the podcast, because what you said is a pretty common refrain, is it almost was accidental. It wasn't something that you necessarily meant to have a career in. But tell me the story. How did you get started in this stuff?
Gosh, you know, I moved back after being away, you know, graduating from high school. I didn't want to go to college right out of the gate. I wanted to have my own place. And so I started in the government, like everybody did who was born and raised in Washington, D.C., like I. And took that old civil service test. If people can believe that, they actually had one then. And got a job and started working in the middle of D.C., just doing administrative work. And then realized that after, you know, moving away for a little bit and coming back and realized, okay, I have to grow up and be an adult now and actually get my degree and start working on a career. And so, you know, probably by that time, I still had a government job since I was 17 years old. I never stopped, never took any pauses in working for the United States government, no matter where I lived. So I probably came back about, you know, 4 or 5 years after into D.C. So I was maybe 22, 23 or something like that, and started working in an Army research lab. And lucky for me, I worked in a program that was the Army's largest special access program. And why was that good? Well, it made me realize, wow, this is pretty cool work. And, you know, I'm seeing these security people doing security things because it was a special access program. I can do that. So I'm putting myself to school, through school, college at night. And I said, I'm going to apply for one of these security positions. If they can do it, I can do it. And so I literally was given a chance by a really, really cool program manager who said, you know, you got potential, girl, that we're going to give you a shot. And so then I just did a security internship and I cut my teeth in that special access program. Why is that relevant? it's relevant because when you're in a special access program, and this one was the largest one in the Army, it was pretty cool technology at the time. I won't go into the details, but it was a program where we were completely integrated with the Air Force and the Navy in a huge special access program environment, which is unusual, first off, because SAPs usually kind of stay to themselves. But what the best part was is you had to, as a SAP security manager, you had to know every discipline of security on a smaller scale, but it really didn't matter. You had to know physical security. You had to know personnel security. You needed access control. You needed OPSEC. You needed to be able to write security classification guidance. You need to understand how security classification works. So you had to do every discipline of security in that program. And that was God's gift to me, you know, because then I became multifunctional, you know, and so many of the people that I knew in security, not in the special access program world, but external to it, were pigeonholed in, I'm a personnel security specialist, or I'm a physical security specialist, or I'm an OPSEC person, or, you know, I do information security. I knew it all because I had to. And so it was truly a gift. And I stayed at that, I kind of cut my teeth on everything in that program, did all my training as I'm going to school at night, trying to get finishing on at my degree. And then I worked my way up to, I don't know what I was at, GS 13, I think, you know, from starting at a GS 5. I had to go backwards from a 7 to a 5 to start into security, which I thought was just like the end of my life at the time, you know, realizing that it was actually a gift, another gift. And anyway, the program was so cool because we did so much with the Air Force and the Navy. So pretty much I ended up knowing everybody and anybody in the special access program world and all the military departments. And that's when I got the offer to go to the Special Operations Command to be their acquisition security manager, which was huge, A, because I was a woman. you know, and SOCOM is, you know, Hua City. And, you know, you have to kind of be a different, well, let's just say it was my character building assignment. I learned how to be tough, you know, and I learned how to persevere, and I learned how to be convincing, you know, to get special operators to follow security guidance. It's almost like
they are particularly disposed not to do.
Right.
I mean, they like to do what they want to do.
Right. And so you had to meet them halfway.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, really, it was just, you know, it was these jobs that I just ended up in just taught me so much. And I mean, not just from the discipline perspective of the security discipline holistically, but really about how to navigate and manage and persevere and influence. And I mean, just all of it. It was really neat. And so I stayed at Special Operations Command for about 3 years. And then I got a job offer to go to Missile Defense Agency, which is, and I became their security manager for multiple disciplines.
Right. A very different place, I would imagine.
Totally. But it was, and Special Access Program was just one of the disciplines that I was responsible for. But the Missile Defense Agency is just, it's so different and eclectic and focused on, obviously, missile defense. But what we ended up doing, because I had done a lot of this in the Special Access Program world, operational testing, we were testing operational missiles in the middle of Kwajalein. And I got to run a lot of those ops from the security perspective. Again, just, I mean, I don't know how I fell into these things. It just, you know, it just kind of happened. So we'd be, you know, over in the middle of the atolls, 8 hours past Hawaii, landing on a little plane strip that's, you know, big enough to hold an airplane, one. And we'd stay there for 6 weeks and run some ops. And it was just, It was another just amazing assignment, and very different, very technical. But, you know, I always had an information assurance or IT person that would support me, because that discipline in the special access program environment, in any environment, as you know, and it keeps getting more and more complicated. It's very technical. You need to be an expert in that. But anyway, we had a cool team, and I did that for about 3 or 4 years. And then I got asked to go to, trying to remember my order of battle here. I went to the, I got to know the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. Carol Hove at the time, I wanted to do a detail. And she said, well, how about going to DSS at the time? She goes, I need somebody to build a security education training and awareness program for the Department of Defense security enterprise. So I did. I did that for like a 6-month stint, went over there, kind of learned about it. And then she hired me. So I did 3 years in building what they call the SPEED program today, Security Professional Education and Development Program. Then I went back to Navy SAPS for a period of time. I put in for the Director of Security for the Army. I had a few folks come to me and say, we really want you to come up here and apply for this job. So I did, expecting, again, who knows? I'm like, oh God, I don't want to drive to the Pentagon. I don't want to be stuck in the Pentagon. Turns out I ended up doing that for 12 years, and it was like the best job ever. And that's where I met you.
Yeah, it was the best. I had so much fun when we were working on that stuff.
Yeah. And then, you know, because we totally reformed personal security, literally for the Department of Defense. And by leading by example with the Army, then you need to get rewarded or punished for your deeds. And
so, a little bit of both sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. So then I went to DCSA when they were bringing the personnel security program and background investigations back to the Department of Defense from OPM. So I got asked to go lead that, and that was where I ended up retiring out of. And, so, I mean, it just one thing kind of just led to another that just leads to opportunities. And sometimes when you don't look so hard, but you just do a good job at what you're doing, it happens, you know?
Well, you tend to do a good job of what you were doing. I mean, that was the cool thing about our time together. And the pattern in your career, it seems to be people just ask you to do things, and maybe it's because you don't know any better, but you just say, okay, I'll go do that. And you do. And maybe it's because you're unconstrained by reality and you just figure, well, we're going to pull this off, and it just kind of works out. So that's a credit. Now, you look back on all of those jobs, and I'm just curious if there, and you mentioned Carol, I believe it was.
Carol Hoff. Mm-hmm.
Are there other folks who really shaped that in terms of the key mentor, key person along the way that really was just without that ingredient, maybe it all doesn't happen. I'm always curious if there are folks like that in your background.
Well, you know, I think when I got to the Army as the Director of Security, and you know, I then became the first senior executive security person for the United States Army. They hadn't ever had a senior executive in the security position, and they created that job when I was the Director of Security for the Army as a GS-15 or whatever, and then. I applied and I got it. And then again, 12 years later, doing all kinds of, I mean, it was funny, John, once you and I like kind of really dug our teeth into, you know, fixing the Army's problem with background investigation submissions, which they literally, you know, my words, sucked. And so it was an easy sell to leadership, to get it fixed. But once we did that, I realized, oh my gosh, continuous improvement applies to everything you touch, right? Every discipline that you're responsible for. It should apply to, it's your mindset when you go to work. How can I make it better, right? And so that's just, that kind of became my mantra. And I just wasn't afraid to try anything, you know, to make it better. But the key was, and so mentors in the Army G2 where I was, there was oddly enough, and this is unusual, there was two or three, you know, one that ran the whole Army budget, one that ran the whole Army IT for Army, two women, Roxanne Hammond and Lynn Schnur, who just, I don't know, it's just they were just phenomenal. And they just kind of took me under their wing. And the current deputy G2 today, Diane Randon, she was another Army. She was all over. I mean, there wasn't a job I think she didn't have on the Army staff as a senior. And it was kind of just weird. Those people took me under their wing, and I just watched a lot, listened a lot, and emulated the behaviors that I liked and believed in.
I mean, I know you said retired, but you're not fully retired because I know you're up to all kinds of things. Tell us a little bit about some of the companies you've been advising, some of the projects you've been involved with since your theoretical retirement.
Yeah, well, it started with System High, and because Rob Howe, who was the CEO, they've subsequently been merged with another private equity firm, but they still have their name, System High. He offered to sponsor me as I came out of the government service, and I just had such respect in him. I had met him through an Air Force SAP back in the days when I was cutting my teeth, if you can believe that. And he was a master sergeant in the Air Force special programs community. And I was, a up and coming, whatever, senior security specialist on the Army side. And, so years later, 40, he's the CEO of a company. And I was retiring from the government for 41 years. And so, they do a lot of research technology protection. They do a lot of SAP security support. They're just a great company. So I started with them, really not doing a whole lot, but just interacting. And then Babel Street came along, a retired general officer, General Mark Quantock, called me up and said, "We'd like you to be on our advisory committee." And their advisory committee was, it was like who's who in the DOD that had just retired, like Bob Ashley, like the commander of JSOC, Dave Glazer, who was the OPMG, the Office of Personnel, Office of Provost Marshal General for the Army. These guys were heavy hitters. And I said, "Okay, Mark, I'm in. I don't know what this is all about." And then that led, to getting your name out there in other, venues. Capella Space, they wanted to learn how to get a facility clearance. And so I helped them with that for a while. Recently, Trusted Security Solutions, TSS is what I'm, Trusted Strategic Solution, sorry. I got called to see if I could help the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering on this contract. So, it's just like who you run into and, are you available? You're actually working? What do you want to do? Would you mind coming, working with us? And it's usually just the, people that you knew, that you had a relationship with, that trusted you, that trusted your advice, that you and I connected after I got out of the government, I called you to say, "Hey," first off, to see how you were, because it's all about relationships, and then you're the one who said, "Hey, you want to do some stuff with us?" When you were in threat switch. And, so I think it's like just relationships that you build, people who have confidence in you. And again, it's kind of like happenstance. One thing led to another. I planned on, just hanging out in my pool on John's Island, South Carolina.
There are worse things. True. You could just hang out on John's Island. It's not a bad plan.
So I'm really glad that I didn't just do that. And then I'm doing stuff like this because it does keep your mind going, relationships going.
Yeah.
And it's interesting.
Yeah. It's certainly fun for me to talk to you. So I'm glad you're doing it. Yeah. Well, I mean, the interesting thing about your background is you have, obviously we were just talking about these very young companies that you're doing work for, but you've also spent a lot of time in literally some of the oldest organizations in the United States. I mean, the Army and Navy are, they're pretty old. One of the things that I think is, and you touched on this a little bit, is transformation inside of these very old, very established, very large organizations. And I think something that a lot of folks could learn from you is, especially in the context of security, but I think it applies in other disciplines too. How in the world do you get these ships to turn? Because they, I mean, you know, obviously the Navy has ships. It was,
sort of Army's tanks to turn. Yeah.
Tanks to turn. So, but how do you make that happen? I mean, I was there for part of it, but so I think I saw some of what you did, but, DCSA, same boat. I mean, how do you get these guys to tackle very big change?
Well, I mean, when you have a problem set that is truly a problem set that needs to be fixed, it's ripe. And so it's not like you're trying to go, you know, change the world and the world's already perfect. So you find a problem and you ask yourself how you can make it better, you know. But the first thing, after you figure out, all right, what you want to try and improve, you know, for the benefit of the mission, I always think that that's forgotten today. You know, none of the public servants are there for themselves. They're there for the mission. And I worry that this generation is not as mission focused as the generation before them. And I hope that's wrong. And it's probably just a misperception on my part. But what can I do to make the mission better? And so, for the Army, once we figured out, okay, we definitely have a problem and we need to fix it. So how do we go about it? Which you helped me with immensely, John, and your company, your small, mean, lean, crazy, good, brilliant people, which is another thing you've always done well. You know, you just hire the best and then you let them go do their job. You know, but once we figured out what the problem was, you have to sell it to leadership.
Yeah.
So I had to sell it to several 3-stars. You know, I think I worked for 5 3-stars during my time on the Army staff. But what was interesting about that, they weren't even just, I mean, my G2s were 3-stars, but you know, then you have the G3 that's a 3-star, and then you have the, you know, Assistant Secretary of the Army. I mean, you have just, you're surrounded by brass up there on the Pentagon staff, and they have to trust you. So you have to establish those relationships, and what you can get done based on a relationship, because they see that you're credible, you're making a difference, you're results oriented, you're committed, you're mission focused. You know, they open doors to you for you. And nothing gets done on the Pentagon staff unless you are coordinating with the G1, with the G3, with the G5-7, you know, I mean, it's really about building those relationships, building that trust, building their confidence by doing your job and getting crap done.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because, I mean, it's not like these organizations don't attempt transformation efforts on the regular. It seems like there's always a sort of a new flavor of, hey, we're going to reform the big thing, whatever the big thing is. And in fact, that's how our project started. It was a broader Army effort to roll out Lean Six Sigma across the whole Army. It had nothing to do with security per se. I wonder if the specific thing that it seems like others fail at when they're trying to affect change in these big organizations is, you know, the inability to get the leadership aligned to the transformation's benefit for them. And I always noticed that you were very good at this, in just the way you interacted with, especially the G2, but also others. Is my diagnosis correct there? I mean, what's the reason why these things fail in your view when people attempt it, and it in contrast to your success?
I think even when you're trying to affect change, again, you got to have that leadership buy-in. They got to trust you, and you got to continuously communicate with them. And you got to listen as well as tell that what you're doing, right? you know, maybe, you know, you're going to the left and they kind of want you to make a little bit of a right turn and then go back to the left, you know. You got to appease. They're the ones that are on the line to get stuff done. They're ultimately responsible. So, you know, you have to respect their wishes. You need to have patience. You need to, what you taught me, measure your success and then tout those measurements, tout those successes. You don't want to, I'll quote Mary Dixon, one of my favorite people from DMDC, senior executive. She was another mentor woman, but amazing. You don't want to boil the whole ocean. You know, you want to start out in the pond and get some success and then build on that. You need to, like I said, be flexible. You need to be willing to change course. You know, sometimes you're not, it's not going to work. And that's okay. You know, you can fail. It's all right. You know, did you try? Did you communicate? Did you do everything right? You know, and you know, maybe it just policy. Policy was the killer for us, if you remember, you know, and it always was in pretty much any kind of change you wanted to make, you know. I remember this vividly on the Army staff, you know, going to my folks that, now we're working with me, you know, they'd say, well, policy doesn't allow for it. And I'd say, who owns policy? And they would say, oh, that would be us, ma'am. And I'm like, well, then let's change it. And let's have it align. You know, I mean, you know, it's so easy to say no. And it's much harder to say yes. But you got to get to yes, and you got to be results oriented, and you got to take on those challenges, and you got to take on those risks, and you can't be afraid.
Yeah. And one thread I want to pull on something you just mentioned, and it had to do with, you know, demonstrating some results or validating the results and measurements part of that. But specific to security, I mean, we're talking a little bit about sort of transformational change. Some of that is process and policy, but thoughts on, for security professionals, I mean, when you're thinking about just implementing a security change, you know, it could be anything. It could be a new system, could be a practice, policy, a vetting procedure, a modification to how they're thinking about access. Talk a little bit about validation of procedures before and how people can use that to maybe affect bigger change. And that's something we talked a little bit about in the pre-call and how to proving it and making sure that something works before you roll it out to a bigger audience is a critical piece of all this.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, you know, you really have to look at what you're trying to change and you have to tear it apart. You and I did that. You know, we took every part of that personnel security background submission process and brought it down to the entity level, right? And then you look at that stuff and then you can kind of see where the warts are. And again, you know, you can't, I would never recommend, you know, just running into a new job and saying, I'm here to fix everything, right? You know,
people don't like that.
Right. As much as I would have loved to do that and probably tried to and then got, you know, shot down and learned, you just need to, you really need to look, study the problem enough to really figure out what needs to be fixed and then fix it in increments. And then, you know, measure those successes, share those successes. I mean, that's what the G2 leadership was so good to me. I mean, to include, you know, and I should have mentioned Jerry Tornbow, my boss. I mean, there really wasn't anything that I would take to him. He would interrogate me. Now, don't get me wrong.
Oh, yes. I watched it happen a couple of times.
Yes. You know, which I thought was good because he was challenging me, you know, I mean, and he was looking out for the Army and looking out for his position, you know, because he knew we had to take it forward to his boss, which was, you know, my boss's boss. But, you know, he supported me. Why? Because we actually got results, you know, and we were making a difference and we had tangible numbers and money that it was saving. And for the Army, the biggest thing that we did was it was a readiness issue. It was a mission. We couldn't get soldiers to the battlefield. We couldn't get soldiers cleared so they could go do their jobs. We couldn't get them clear so they could enlist. And so that meant working with the G1 and fixing things. So we, you know, in the course of fixing that, we ended up, you know, fixing, helping the G1 fix their accessions process. You know, it was just amazing. You know, it's kind of like a puzzle, or just, you know, one thing leads to another, and, you know, you follow that trail and you try and get people in, you know, with you. And it's all done through people, John, you know? And so, and if you remember, one of our biggest, what we did, which I learned so much from this, is when we actually rolled out our new process for background investigation submissions for the Army, we enlisted the biggest naysayer. This isn't going to work. So then we offered him to help us, if you remember. Why don't you? And he, then all of a sudden he was like in like Flynn, and he was just on top of things, and he was like, we can do this. And he was our champion. So it was kind of amazing to see how that emotions changed when he was part of the process.
You know, it's so interesting that you worked on both sides. I mean, the stories you're telling now about the Army and clearance reform, a lot of that was about fixing a broken process. I mean, we were really focused on efficiency and effectiveness and speed and, you know, and also cost effectiveness. There were plenty of other situations where you were sort of on the other side of it's not exactly the other side of the coin, but it definitely is a different perspective on the priority for solving a problem. And it's this string of very high profile security, I'll call them lapses, problems, incidents. The Navy Yard shooting is the one that comes to mind. That's by no means the only one, but that was one that you were heavily involved in. And it has me thinking about how you approached access. I mean, you know, we were obviously this is access to information, but it's also access to facilities and how you badge people in and out and how you do background checks on and make sure that they're where they're supposed to be and not where they're not supposed to be. How did those high profile incidents change your thinking about how we give access to people, to both information and facilities? Because some of those were, you know, pretty painful, and there was loss of life involved. It was very serious stuff. And you were right at the point of the spear of all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. For some reason, it was just that period of time. We had the Hassan shooting. Then we had WikiLeaks. Then I remember the Navy Yard, and I wasn't working at the Navy Yard at the time, but the director of security for the Navy was dear friend, Wendy Kai. And I can remember when it happened, it hit the TV and my phone rang. And it was Wendy. She goes, you got to help me through this, you know, because we had already done those kind of triage, you know, things before.
And just to refresh everybody's memory, because some folks who are listening to this might, believe it or not, they might be too young to remember what happened. But walk us through what the Navy Yard shooting was so they have context for that call from Wendy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously there was you're testing my memory. I need to call a friend, Wendy. Remind me what exactly.
We should have her on the podcast. That's a great idea.
Exactly. She'd be great. I know she's retired now, happy, and working for one of our great contractors out there as well. But she would be the one to really talk to about this. But, you know, it had everything to do with vetting, right? And access, and making sure that, you know, the people who had that our access control systems, and I mean to include even issuance of a CAC, right?
Yeah.
You know, it really kind of led to, hey, by the way, we can give people these credentials and then we never look at them again. Right? So that kind of led to continuous evaluation. You know, you're going to get more bang for your buck by, you know, we need to look at people more than every 5 years. Or we need to look at these people a little more, you know, discreetly when you're issuing something that's going to get them into a, you know, facility as big as the Navy Yard or as big as Fort Hood in the Hassan case. And so it really kind of led to continuous evaluation, but it led to what are we vetting against? You know, what are the criteria on which we are using our And you know, the U.S. government is still in that process, and I still don't think that it's currently and it might never be completely right, right? I think it always needs to be looked at. It's that whole continuous improvement thing that we've talked about, John. But, you know, one thing that comes to my mind, and this is really serious, was our contract linguists. This is just another vetting story, right? So for the Army, we would employ linguists to go on, you know, when we were in Iraq and we were in Afghanistan, to go alongside with our troops, you know, to help them execute their mission in very, very dangerous areas, right? And so how do you vet those guys? Well, we ended up, you know, using all the knowledge that we had gleaned and gained from these crises that we talked about, you know, to how do we vet these guys? And it was really near and dear to my heart because I had two boys in the fight, you know. And I mean, all I could think of is, yeah, I want, you know, whoever is translating for him, who's a native of that country, I want to know that he's the good guy, right? And not bringing one of my sons into danger, you know. And so we, along with the deputy G2, Mr. Jeffrey Rapp, we built a huge program, and it's different because it's when you're looking at somebody who's a United States board person and you're looking at somebody who's not, you can't use the same standards, right? So you need to, you know, adjust fire, so to speak, and really take a look at those relevant things. I tell you, in vetting today, whether it be vetting vendors to make sure the supply chain's safe, doing a lot of that these days, or whether it's vetting people for a clearance or access or what have you, I don't think, and this is my humble opinion, I'm not in the government anymore, but I do not think that we use open source data enough, because I really believe, of course we're going to do the FBI checks and the standard checks that we always have done for clearances, but I think there's so much more out there on these people in open source, and there's so many incredible technologies out there that can go do a deep dive in some of these things that can pull the string to lead you to something you would have never found just doing your standard government checks for a background investigation.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you mentioned the multidisciplinary thing from the very beginning of your career. It feels like you're pulling that thread again here. I mean, that it's when it comes to vetting, I mean, I'm just thinking about a company who's badging people in and out, or they might be visitors, they might be employees too. Yeah. That if they think it's only about the physical perimeter access, or they think it's just about the badge, or they think it's just about the background check, any one of those things sounds like maybe by itself the wrong answer.
Right.
But it's a lot more than that.
Which kind of leads you to the insider threat, right? Which is another thing that we had the opportunity to do when I was on the Army staff with the G2. I tell you, one thing that we did in the Army G2, the seniors, the senior for counterintelligence, the senior for security, me, we worked so closely together. And that's an anomaly. Usually counterintelligence people stay in their little lane, and security, they never talk to security people. We absolutely merged everything. And then we brought the G3 guys in, the operational guys, and we built an insider threat program for the Department of the Army. And it was just so rewarding, but we all brought little pieces, and put that, you know, puzzle together. Like, what should we be looking at? What should we be concerned with? You know? I go back to one thing led to another that led to another, you know, and they were really just opportunities that, or tragedies that led to opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, you hate to say that anything good comes from a tragedy, but one of the things that, you know, I certainly learned from just being around the field and watching you and other teams, I think it's affected how commercial organizations think about security too, is that look, there are probably really lives at stake here from time to time. Not always, but it's not just about making sure that nobody steals our stuff. That, you know, there is, you know, in mass casualty, kind of mass shooting events, obviously, you know, terrorist attacks. Hearing these stories, I've noticed in talking to the commercial folks who lead security teams that they use those as reference points, and they very much do pay attention to how the government responds to those attacks to try to figure out how they can protect themselves. So it has effects that extend beyond the government for sure. When you think about, I mean, in those situations, it requires, I mean, I think tremendous leadership from everybody involved, especially at the top of the chain. But I want to know what you think is different about leadership and security. I mean, you know, there are tons of leadership frameworks out there. You hear, you know, companies talk about what it means to be a leader, but, you know, I feel like there's something a little bit different in security leadership that's important. And I just want to get your take on that. What's different about being a security leader from being just a CEO of a company?
Security people aren't the first people invited to the dinner tables.
Sometimes they ruin the party.
Right, right. We're like, oh God, we're just going to tell us no, you know. I always thought that was funny, and I learned that way early in my career. You know, working with the engineers in this big special access program that we worked in. You know, I learned one thing, and it was, you need to never say no. And this, I really learned it in SOCOM because these guys were just like a pain. And I mean, they were so smart and so brave.
You can say pain in the ass on the podcast.
I had such respect, but I'm like, how do I get to them and make them like want to like follow these freaking rules? And it's really just about being persuasive and getting to know them and just, you know, making them know that you give a crap, and that you're not here to say no. So my motto was, don't say no, say how. And living by that, and SOCOM taught me a lot. I went home and cried a lot of nights. I'm like, they're so mean. Just made me tougher, and it just kind of like, you know, it got under my skin a little bit and maybe like got my temper up, and then I'm like, all right, I'm going to take them on. And then I had to figure out how to do that, you know, and I had to become one of them, I guess, is what really, and earn their respect. And it was fine. I just learned so much from them. But you can't tell them no. You just got to say how and why.
And it doesn't seem like there are a lot of, I mean, if you think about security teams, at least the ones I've been around, there aren't a whole lot of problem-solving cultures in security teams. They tend to be perceived as erecting obstacles. So what's the most important ingredient in getting their teams to become problem solvers? Because the leader might get it. They might completely drink what you're pouring right now, but they can't get their junior employees in the security team to change the way that they act in order to become that problem-solving security team. How do you get the team to come along?
Well, first off, you don't go in and preach. You really have to listen more than you talk. That's hard. That's hard as a leader. And I go back to, you know, when I moved to DCSA in my last move for my career, one of the war stories was the adjudication facility. Mm-hmm. And those guys were just being worked to death, you know. And one of the first things I did was doing, I hate to use the word sensing sessions because that's not what it was. I just would call them it by groups because there was 800 plus adjudicators. So it wasn't like I'm going to have one big, or I'd have to, you know, rent an arena.
And just for everybody's benefit, if they're commercial, this is the central adjudication facility that processes all of the security clearance determinations for everybody.
Yes, for Department of Defense.
Yes, everybody. Probably north of 1.5 million of those things a year.
Yeah, and probably more.
Yeah.
But these guys, they felt so underloved. You know, that nobody was listening to them, and, you know, they were just, you know, workhorses. And anyway, we had these sessions, and literally I would just sit in the middle of a room with, I guess we probably maybe did it 100 at a time, maybe. And I said, all right, what do you got? Tell me what you're feeling. Tell me what you're thinking, you know? And the stuff that they were thinking and the things that they wanted were little things that were so easy to fix. Because I listened. And then, but I didn't just listen. I think one of the things is you have to align your actions with your words. I mean, so, you know, I never promised anything at those meetings, but I said, we're going to document all these things. We're going to look at them and anything I can change to what, you know, within reason to meet your requirements and meet what you're asking for, I'm going to change. And we did. And I mean, I tell you what, that workforce, I mean, that job is hard. It's monotonous. It's important. You know, you're making a decision to, you know, give somebody access to classified information. That's a big deal. It's relentless. But I tell you, I was so rewarded by that staff. I was rewarded by that staff. I could get in an elevator or be walking to my car, and I can't tell you how many times they would run up to me and hug me, you know? And I get teary-eyed when I think about it, you know? It was so rewarding.
Yeah, that's great to hear because, and I've heard this from multiple guests on this podcast, is it's hard to attract people to security disciplines of all types. Not just, we're talking about personnel security primarily here, but it also, even to cyber, which is probably, I guess, the sexiest right now. I mean, you know, to the extent that you could pick one that you would describe as sexy, that I guess that's it.
God bless those people.
But all of these roles, there's a certain amount of grind involved in all of these roles. And I've heard other leaders who we've talked to talk about the idea that people think they're going to get into security and it's going to be cooler than it actually turns out to be because there's just this grind. Sometimes there are punctuated cool moments, but how do you keep that junior workforce motivated when they're in the grind and it's in between, you know, the incidents that maybe are exciting?
I call them little changes. They weren't little changes to them. They were big changes. It was a big deal to them, you know, you know, then we got to a point where, you know, we had a special need to actually adjudicate. I don't know. It was an extraordinary number of cases in X number of days because there was a mission or whatever it was at the time. And so we kind of made it, we incentivized it and kind of made it a contest, you know, and I mean, I consistently communicated with them. Always sent an email out at the end of the week, telling them where they were, how proud of them I was, you know, always hugged them in the elevator, you know, anytime I could. And I know that sounds corny, but you know, it was truly relations. And it was really, really, really special. But I think that the key to your question is, you know, you got to listen as much as, you know, you tell them what you want done, you know, cause you're the boss. Right. But, you got to listen to their input. Maybe they have better ideas than you do. They probably do because they're doing the work, you know? And I think I said this when we were just talking randomly, you know, you may dare to be different. If we've always done it that way, you know, well, let's not do that anymore. Let's try it a different way and let's see the results we get. And if it fails, that's okay. We'll go back to the other way. But you know, you got to be open. You got to have personal relationships with these people. You got to talk to them. You got to listen to them. You got to let them know you care. You know, you give a crap. And you don't do it just by a bunch of hot air. You do it by, you know, the actions you take as a leader. Yeah. And they're watching all the time. But it can be as rewarding and it can be grueling and it can be cumbersome and it can be frustrating, and it's probably going to be all those things, you know, but you just got to keep your mission focused. And that was another thing, you know, they needed to know what they were working for and why it was important.
Switching gears a little bit, something that you've touched on this a couple of times. I don't think this happened on purpose. I think it happened out of necessity. You've been involved in some pretty major deployments of technology to solve some of these problems. And of course you're now working with a bunch of companies that are primarily technology companies that are trying to affect change through deployment of technology to solve security problems. What's your take on the role of technology? I mean, obviously people think about security technology, their brain goes to cyber first, although that's, in my experience, that's the tip of the iceberg for where it applies. How has that changed how you've how you solve problems, and what's your take on how technology, what role technology has to play in solving all security discipline problems?
I think it's critical. I think it's essential. I think if you're not looking at it and looking at what's state of the art out there, here's where I think the government gets it wrong sometimes. And I'm not calling out any specific agencies, because I think a lot of them do this, and, you know, they want to build it there. But there's technology companies out there that's their expertise. Why are you going to do that? You know, why are you not looking for the best of the best and then managing it and applying it to your problem set? You know, I just think, and a lot of it is just old think. I think that the government really needs to reverse its thinking on, you know, find those technologists and technology companies out there and use them, you know, use them to help solve your problems. Because you're so far behind the power curve if you're not doing that.
Is there anything in particular? I mean, it could be from one of the companies you're working with now, or something, just something that you've run across that you think is particularly promising that you would say, gosh, everybody needs to think about adopting that right now.
I'm gonna go straight to Babel Street, which will appreciate this.
I'm sure they will. Plug. It's fine.
Like I said, General Quantat brought me into Babel Street. He's not even with Babel Street anymore. I'm still on the board. Why I'm still on the board, I don't know.
Oh, you're pretty smart. There are probably several good reasons.
Well, you know, they have built a vendor vetting tool. Okay, so like DCSA could use this vendor vetting tool in probably almost every one of their missions, right? To identify foreign ownership, control, and influence when you're issuing a facility clearance, to get after the new requirement to vet companies before you award a $5 million or less contract. The personnel security, I go back to open source information should be the basis for a background investigation. You start there. And then you see where those, and then you go to the authoritative data sources that are the government data sources, like the FBI checks, et cetera. But start with that basis that you would never get. It might lead you places where you don't even need to go get that FBI check because it's a non-starter, you know. Their vendor vetting tool could take the foci requirements. And foci is so prevalent. It's prevalent in supply chain issues, granting acquisition, granting contracts, facility clearances, people clearances. This vendor vetting tool is amazing. And they really, I think a few of the combatant commands are actually using it. It takes the workload of those poor analysts that get inundated with information down to, okay, these are the true crown jewels of what we need to look at here. Or, oh my gosh, this company that we're looking at has ties to our friends, or not so friends. And they're clear as a bell. Their tool has just grown. I mean, when I came on with them as an advisor, they were doing mainly for OSINT, a lot for the special ops community, you know, OSINT work and doing a deep dive into what's out there. I mean, they've added AI to it. They translate in over 200 languages at the touch of a button. What's on the internet, 75% of what's on the internet is not in English. Their tool already adjusts to that. They have identity matching. They acquired a company with the best identity matching. They've just added so much to their portfolio that I don't know why. I don't care where you are in the government. You know, you're going to have the requirement in the acquisition side. You're going to have the requirement in the security side. You're probably going to have the requirement in the finance side to know you're dealing with the right people. I mean, Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering has a responsibility to make sure the components are vetting their vendors.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just government too. I had a great talk with, I will not say the name of a tier one government contractor, that you probably know. And the question came up on vendor vetting specifically, and some of it was about personnel, but some of it was also about the companies in their supply chain. In some cases, they're working on a single project for DOD that might have 30,000 suppliers.
Right.
And their visibility into the tier immediately below them is pretty good. Beyond that, they have no freaking idea.
Right.
And about either the people or the companies that are doing the work. And that supply chain visibility problem, it seems like one of the most acute things that the defense industrial base is dealing with.
Yes. The DIB needs to look at the battle street capability and think about utilizing it. But so does the government. I mean, they're not the only ones out there, but I tell you, they will rival any tool that's out there. It's pretty amazing what they've built and what they can render.
Next thing really is, it relates to the old and new question. You know, obviously the old organization, new organization question that I asked you earlier about how to handle old organizations. I mean, if you advise, I mean, obviously we're talking about both of these entities. What could, I mean, it could be the Army or the Navy or DCSA or one of these giant agencies or a tier one, these very large, very old organizations, excuse me. What's the most important thing that they could learn from these smaller, more agile companies that you're advising now?
Well, I think it's kind of like some of the theme that we've already talked about, you know, I mean, and I can use Battle Street just as a prime example. You know, they didn't start out with all of these tools. They started out with very limited capability, but, you know, they built on them. They listened to what the problem sets were out in the wild, whether it be the DIB or whether it be in the government, or what comes into legislation, right, as a requirement. And they have built on to success and added capabilities that will improve that success.
Yeah. As opposed to going big bang, I guess. Right. See, the government seems to try to do a lot, and so do big companies.
Well, yeah, that's what, you know, I mean, God bless them, but the government is not, you know, they're not the best at building IT systems, you know, but there are people out there, there's companies out there that are damn good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we ought to use more of them. There's got to be, I understand the ownership. I understand we want it to be proprietary from a government perspective, but there's got to be a happy medium there. And gosh knows there's enough lawyers that could craft a contract that would protect the government's interests.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Switching gears. I want to ask some more fun, quick questions for you. This is the rapid fire round.
Be kind to me, John.
I didn't tell you any of these in advance. They are fun. All right. First one's easy. Most surprising lesson from your 40-ish years in security.
God, I didn't know that I was going to be so much into continuous improvement and innovations. And they got me. They started driving me at the end, or not the end, but, you know, mid-career. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we have to do this now. And they just excited me. But I think the thing that touches my heart more than anything is the mentorship, the people that would come in and ask me to be mentors for them, and just having a relationship with them and talking to them and helping them grow and seeing them actually take some of my jobs as I moved on or moved out. So that was very rewarding.
All right. Next one. What's your best source of information for keeping up with security trends? What'd you learn from? What's the number one resource?
I think it's as best you can, keeping up with policy and keeping up with, hanging out from a DOD perspective. Okay. Hanging out with the DIB, the Defense Industrial Base. Because they're on the cutting edge, A, of actually getting stuff done or building stuff, or both, or supporting operations, and just keeping relevant on as much as I hate policy.
Well, you've got to know your enemy.
You do. And I mean, and you have to know, see the new ones. Yeah, so what cracks me up is that the government, they will get it out of an NDAA or something like that. The government, you know, 3 years later, the government hasn't even implemented it. Much as implemented it, shit, they haven't even written the policy, you know? And then, you know, and then they haven't even implemented it after that. And so, you know, if there was a way that, you know, that could be a much more agile process, I think the government would be in a greater place.
Well, you know, that reminds me of a term that you coined that I use all the time, and that is folklore. and maybe I'll reframe my prior question this way. It's not exactly the dumbest security mistake, but folklore, you and I have talked about this many times. It's things that people believe are policies or are true, but are not. And we run into that all the time. And I'm curious if you have any favorite pieces of folklore that you've come across.
I really think the whole personnel security background investigation mission, you know, pull any piece apart on it. And usually people have it totally wrong. You know, your clearance is going to expire. No, your investigation may be a little bit old and you need to get it updated, you know? And then with that takes you back to, you know, doing a background investigation every 5 years and then never looking at anybody again.
That's not real smart.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I am significantly crazier than I was 5 years ago.
I never understood that concept. And then, but trying to get continuous evaluation a thing in the government was like, I mean, I always remember when, you know, because, you know, you have to go up to the DNI and there's a whole bunch of gyrations you have to go through. And I think when I was proposing something like this with a few of my counterparts in the Pentagon, they were looking at us like we needed a psyche bow, you know, like, you guys need some help because that shit ain't sailing. And then, you know, 5 years later, we were doing it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. That's usually the way it went. All right. Totally different kind of question. You live in lovely John's Island now, which don't blame me. It's fantastic down there. Love it. What is one thing you miss about being in DC?
The joy of my career was working in the Pentagon. I never thought I would love that environment, but, and I think you could write books on, you know, working in the Pentagon and working on, you know, pick a military department staff, right? In my case, it was the Army G2, but, so, so rewarding. And you learn how to get things done in the Pentagon, and you really can get a whole lot of stuff done in the Pentagon if you know how to maneuver. And a lot of it is based on relationships.
Yeah.
And really special ones came out of that job, and which is probably why I was there for so long. But and that's not good. I wouldn't recommend anybody stay in any place too long. However, we were changing stuff the whole 12 years I was there. Yep. You know, there wasn't anything that we didn't look at and turn over and say, how can we make it better? Disciplines that we were responsible full side. And we got a lot of respect.
All right. Final thing, I want to give you the last word here. There are lots of aspiring leaders and current leaders in both commercial and government who might hear this podcast. What's the one thing you want to make sure that they remember? Closing thoughts.
Always look inward at yourself on how you can make things better before you, you know, cast aspersions on other people how they're screwed up. You know, I mean, that's an easy thing to say and not an easy thing to do, but I learned it the hard way. When you get to the senior executive level, that's why there's a whole protocol that kind of goes with that. And it's so respectful. It's wonderful. And so I would, you know, just never count anybody out. Always believe, you know, if there's a mountain climb, you can do it. Always go into an organization, people first. Make sure you listen a lot. And don't be afraid to be a risk taker and change, but definitely get your leadership buy-in before you just jump off a cliff.
Well, for sure, you are a risk taker and made change, which I think it makes that makes it a privilege to talk to you every single time we have a chance to catch up. This has been a total delight. I love hearing these stories, even though I know some of the stories and I've heard some of the stories. I love hearing them again from you. It's fantastic. And you've done an awful lot of good for the community. And I think everybody will learn a ton from hearing your insights and experience. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sign In Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit signinsolutions.com. Until next time, stay secure, stay informed,